President. Pat Breen, who has put this together this morning. We want to thank Pat for that. He's the Vice President. And we have Lorraine McSorley, the President of the LAOH. And Sister Eileen O'Leary, the Chaplain of the LAOH. And to my left over here, we have John Horgan, who is a fellow brother of ours, who's going to do the presentation today. Also, at this time, I'd like to acknowledge in the audience some past presidents. Past presidents of the LAOH, Shirley Conley. And the past presidents of the AOH, Billy Gilday and Dick Johnson. It's a wonderful day out there today, isn't it? It's really nice. The weather is here. The spring, summer is upon us now. And I just want to say that, you know, the communion breakfast is an important time for us. It's a time that we can remember all our deceased brothers and all the people before us that have worked so hard to make this organization what it is and this division what it is. So I feel very strongly about this communion breakfast, and you know, let's go forward with it. It was a pretty good turnout this year, although we'd like a little bit more people. Maybe next year we can work on it more and get more people in. But I do want to thank everybody for being here. Right at this time, I'd like to introduce Lorraine McSorley from the LAOH president, just to say hello.
I just want to thank everybody for coming. It's a great turnout. I'm happy to all be here. I hope we can have some more than one during the year. Thank you.
Thank you, Lorraine. And now I'd also like to introduce Dick Thompson, our state president.
Thank you, Leo. As many of you know, just to bring up on some of the events of the state, we had our state convention about 2 weeks ago now, and I was fortunately reelected state president for another 2 years. And I again thank the brothers and sisters here that have supported me for the last 2 years. I'll probably be looking for more support in the 2 years to come. Our next big event is on the state level. It will be the John Boyle O'Reilly exercises on June 20th. It will be at 11 a.m. Mass at the Holyhood Cemetery at the grave site of John Boyle O'Reilly. And we'll be back here at Division 14 for a little light refreshments, reception type situation. The other thing that I know a lot of people are starting to ask me about, because our national president, Seamus Boyle, put me in charge of the Gros Seal trip, Gros Seal celebration here on the U.S. side. That I'll have information. I believe the ladies' meeting is tomorrow evening. My mother's asked me, I'll get the information. She'll have some information available at the ladies' meeting. I'll bring the information to the men's meeting. I know there's been some interest expressed. That trip is scheduled for August 14th to the 16th. Many of you know, Gros Seal is a quarantine station up in Canada in the St. Lawrence River, just outside of Quebec City, where there's over 5,000 in one mass grave, but they predict there's probably 7,000 famine Irish that lost their life to different diseases while they were quarantined on that island. So in 1909, the AOH of America put up a 45-foot high cross on the highest point of the island, Telegraph Hill. And if anyone that's been up there, as you come up the St. Lawrence River and you come upon Gros Seal, that cross sticks out immensely. It's quite the sight to see. So we're going to try to organize either at the division level or the state level. I know many divisions are after me now. Some type of chartered transportation, or as I get more numbers, I'll work on that. I'll let you know. And again, just to remediate with some of what Leo was saying, that unfortunately this past week I've been to too many funerals of Hibernian brothers. We lost a national member, Bud Foley, a national life member, Bud Foley, out in Marlboro at this time last week. And then in the middle of the week, have you a good friend of Division 14, David Burke, died up in Lawrence. And just yesterday I was over in Lynn, Joe Gallagher, past Essex County president, and Lynn Division president, passed away. So as Leo said, communion breakfasts are the way that we remember these deceased brothers. I know the brothers and sisters come out during the funerals and the wakes, and which is great, but the, you know, years down the line, these people are gone, and we don't want to forget their commitment and what they've done to our organization as a whole, and particularly to our divisions. And it's very important to keep these traditions of the communion breakfast to remind us of the men and women that came before us to, that have made this organization what it is for us to carry on. I thank you and enjoy the day.
Thanks, Dick. I wish I could talk like Dick, but I'm learning. I mean, I still have my notes, but he just wings it. I don't know how he does it. You know, at the convention, he get up there to 5 minutes before they get to speak. I said, "So you all set? You got your speech ready?" And he says, "Now, just, you know, think of something." You know, and he did a great job at it. So it's great, and it's great to see on our division level here the people that are dedicated to this organization. Lorraine stepping up this year as the LAOH was very happy, as we all know, the women had some difficulty in getting some people to help them with their future endeavors, and having people step up like that is a tremendous commitment on their part, and I applaud Lorraine for that. And as well as Dick stepping up in the state, we love to see him up there, and I think we'll just see more and better things with Dick. On the divisional level here, things have been going pretty well. I mean, I'm not going to go over everything. I think most of you have seen my bulletin, and boy, did we put a lot of news in it this month. I mean, it was full, chock full of everything. And Eddie has it on the website, right, Ed?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
First time before the bulletin was set up.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He's been on my back for about 6 months to do it, and I finally made sure that I get done this time. So, you know, like I said, we're learning up here. We're still learning, so we're doing great. At this time, I would like to introduce John Horrigan to do our presentation. John did a great thing for us in March. We had the Irish History Month down in the library. We did two series down there of speakers, and John was one of them. And he did a great job, and we were so impressed with it that when we were talking about speakers, maybe for our community breakfast, we thought it would be great that we had John come out because of what he did. He puts a lot of time into this, and he's very generous with his time to the Hibernians. Anytime we call upon him, he's there to do something for us, speak or do whatever he can do to help out this organization. And, you know, it's what I try to get from most of our members here is we're not looking for an everyday commitment. We're looking for a few hours from you, and that's what we get. And everybody in this room knows that. And I'm looking out here, and everybody that I see puts more than a few hours in, so I appreciate that from everybody. And here's John. Thank you.
Thank you, Leo. Doesn't Leo look great, everybody, huh?
I had watermelon while you had bacon.
Leo, if you could keep me honest to the clock, maybe quarter of, or let me know, because I know that we have a graduation party. It's a pleasure to be here at the Hibernian Hall. See a lot of friends here. Dez, I've known for quite some time because I run a lot of functions here. Eileen from St. Pat's. Father Barr from St. Pat's. Wonderful sermon about letting God out of the box in the back room and into your life. A great sermon. And then, of course, my brothers and sisters from the Hibernian. It's just a pleasure to be able to say God and Jesus and not look over your shoulder to see if anybody listens. So, basically, I'm a fire researcher. I research historical fires. I spent some time with the Southeastern Massachusetts fire chiefs the other day. And I'm also a historical weather researcher. And with that, fire and weather comes disasters. And that's how I was introduced to the St. John. I've been called, amongst other things, a pocket historian. My favorite is a rogue nostalgian and an old New England folklorist. But basically, I'm interested in rolling out mysteries, disasters, weather phenomena to crowds, whether they be elderly, they can't see, or any sort of civic organization. And if I break out into a hockey announcer's voice, I apologize in advance. I work with the Boston Bruins alumni as their show hockey announcer. And in fact, they're taking me to Ireland, my first trip to the homeland, in September, so I'm really blessed in that regard, yeah. And I'm the New England Patriots basketball announcer, if there is such a thing. And I found myself a Walpole on Tuesday night for 3 hours, sitting between Kevin Falk, a running back, and Logan Mankins and Russ Hochstein on the other side. So God is good, and that's what I want to just tell you, that God is good, God is great. I'm also a reenactor and belong to the Watertown Historical Society. Cell phone's off, please. Usually when I say that, mine rings, but mine isn't here. You can contact me through my website, ushistory.me. I know it was available, believe it or not. We're going to go over a few things tonight. Talk about 1849, something that I call a scarcity of Tatey's. The Famine Queen, the Dream, the Hannah, the Storm, the Voyage, the Observer, and then Great South Shore Shipwrecks. I don't know if we're going to have time for that. But if you don't worry about reading the text, I trust you, I will drive the narrative from here, so don't bother about reading it. So to start off, we have to get back to 1849, and we can either take the time machine from my friend H.G. Wells or get in the car with this guy from Back to the Future. And tell you what, I ain't riding with that guy. Time machine reminders, no smoking, shoes off please, pass through the detector one at a time before boarding, hands inside the vehicle, seat belts fastened, a nominal fee of $5 to rent a pillow, snacks are no longer complimentary, there are numerous hidden surcharges, and I've just learned that our trip this morning has been delayed by 2 hours. All right, here we go. My wife insists take this out of your presentation, but I think you have to get back to the year, so here we go. Okay, it's the year 1849. So what's going on in the year 1849? Well, on February 28th, regular steamboat service from the east to the west coast of the United States begins with the arrival of the SS California in San Francisco Bay. The California left New York Harbor on October 6th, 1848, rounded Cape Horn at the tip of South America, and arrived at San Francisco after a four-month, 21-day journey. March 3rd, the Department of the Interior established the Gold Coinage Act. Who was the second 12th president of the United States of America? The second 12th president. Anybody? Anybody recognize this guy? Hero from the... from the Mexican-American War. Close, Tyler. It's Zachary Taylor. Zachary Taylor refused to be sworn in as president on this Sabbath, Sunday, March 4th, 1849. After hearing this, Taylor's vice president-elect, Millard Fillmore, seen on the right, decided to take spirits in a pre-inaugural celebration. So who was the first 12th president of the United States? Seeing that Zach Taylor wouldn't be sworn in, it was this man. And as I mentioned, it wasn't Millard Fillmore. He had been overserved that day. Urban legend holds that David Rice Acheson, president pro tempore of the United States Senate, was the first 12th president du jour for a single day sworn in on Sunday, March 4th, 1849. Taylor would ascend to the office the following day. Here's President Taylor in his cabinet. This is an early daguerreotype by Matthew Brady, circa 1849. I thought it was interesting. And Taylor's the one in the middle. Just some background about Zachary Taylor. His death is not well understood. July 4th, 1850, he has a snack of milk and cherries at an Independence Day celebration. 5 days later, he dies of gastroenteritis on July 9th, 1850. Anyways, there was a theory going around that he was murdered. They had his body exhumed by specialists at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and they found out that he wasn't poisoned. He died of bad cherries and bad milk. Some other things, unfortunately, when you look at history of 160 years ago, you look at the bad things that took place. And April 6th, Windsor, Ontario catches fire only to be saved by the Detroit Fire Brigade, and they regale them with the finest things in the city. And I'll leave that to your imagination and what they gave them. April 21st, 96 inmates of the overcrowded Ballinrobe Union Workhouse die over the course of the preceding week from illness and other famine-related conditions, a record high. The dead were buried in unmarked, shallow graves. On May 3rd, there's a break in the Mississippi River, levee at Sauvage Crevasse, and it floods much of New Orleans, Louisiana. I try to tell people that's not the first time New Orleans has been decimated from Hurricane Katrina. Minnesota becomes a state on the 11th of May. 2 days later, and I put this in because we're in Watertown, the Great Fire of Watertown, New York, begins in Stagecoach Shed and burns the downtown entire district. The first Great Fire in Watertown, incidentally, was 1841 at the corner of Church and Main. Stables and the motel went up. And then the St. Louis fire begins on May 17th. It starts when a steamboat catches fire and nearly burns down the entire city. $5 million worth of damage, $1,849, and 23 steamboats are lost. Residents of St. Louis had to paddle out to the middle of the river, Mississippi River, to survive. And then May 25th at 10 o'clock, the steamer Empire and the schooner Noah Brown collide on the Hudson River at Newburgh, and over 100 drowned. So not many good things were going on in 1849. 130,000 Russian troops pour into Hungary on June 1st. French troops occupy Rome. The Roman Republic surrenders. There's an opposite for once in a while, somebody surrendering to France. July 6th, the Danish army beats the Prussian army at Jutland. And then September 1st, 1849, the first segment of the Pennsylvania Railroad from Lewiston, Pennsylvania to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania opens for service. Johann Strauss dies on the 25th of September. Edgar Allan Poe dies on October 7th. And Frederic Chopin dies on October 17th. And then November 16th, Fyodor Dostoevsky is sentenced to death for anti-government activities. His execution is canceled at the last moment. The inventions that we have in 1849, the conical bullet, it's a bad year, the safety pin, chewing gum, and Lord Kelvin discovers absolute zero. The telegraph is in use in limited capacity, so parts of Boston, as are some major coastal towns, are strung for limited service. It's only 5 years since Samuel Morse sent the message, "What hath God wrought?" So in 1849, we have primitive telegraph service, which is important, and primitive railroad service in Boston and in New England. And of course, in 1849, the California Gold Rush, what people fail to realize sometimes, it was discovered a year earlier. James Marshall found gold flakes at John Sutter's mill on January 24th, 1848, but the rush started the next year. So let's look at Ireland now, a map of Ireland. And again, I know that you can't see this, especially the people that are up in section 308 back there. But basically, it's showing you the lowest class housing and versus literacy rate. In other words, the percent of people that lived in poverty and the percent of people that lived, that could read and write. And I'm going to just go up to the map and show you. But basically, to the right of Ireland in Dublin, for instance, 9% of the people in Dublin in 1849 or in the 1840s lived in poverty. Not bad. 1 in 10. 54% of the people in Dublin could read and write, so they're very well educated. Kildare, 27% were impoverished, 35% could read. And then moving now to the west of Ireland, where the severity of the famine hit.
Mayo, Galway, Clare, Limerick, Cork. Okay.
Mayo, 68%. In low-class housing, and you're going to see what I mean about low-class housing. We're talking dugouts. 13% were literate. Galway, half of the people were impoverished. Only 15% could read or write. Clare, half the people were impoverished. Only a quarter could read or write. Limerick, half the people were impoverished. Over 33% could read or write. Cork, half the people were impoverished. Over a quarter could read or write. And Kerry, 68% were impoverished. 23%. Could read or write. You're looking at very, very poor areas of Ireland. Of course, in 1704, the penal codes. Catholics could not buy land. Catholics could not inherit land from Protestants. Catholic fathers had to bequeath land equally to sons unless one was a Protestant, and then he inherited it all. Catholics could not lease land for more than 31 years. Catholics had to take the oath. The king was the spiritual leader. No mass could be celebrated. A tithe to support Protestant clergy. One priest to a parish. Unfortunately, that's happening to the Catholics in Boston nowadays. An exile of Catholic bishops. No formal education. No Trinity College. Banned from professions. No intermarriage. No vote in parliamentary elections. No political military offices. No guns or weapon. No horse more than five hands. So for you English revisionists, I know you're not here today to say that it wasn't as severe as you think. You're wrong, and you're lying. So here's the color codification now of the severity of the Great Famine. The blood red that you see in the west is where it was 100% of the people suffered from the famine. And then you go down to the red area and orange. As you can see, the west was absolutely decimated. The Great Famine, known as the Great Hunger, and Gortamore. Did I say that right, my brothers and sisters? And Gorta Moore, The Great Hunger, Dick, yeah. And Drogshal. And Drogshal. The product of the Irish potato famine, the good product was the Irish diaspora. The Irish diaspora consists of Irish emigrants and their descendants in countries such as Great Britain, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Argentina, Mexico, and states of the Caribbean in continental Europe. Maximally interpreted, it contains over 80 million people, which is over 14 times the population of Ireland in the year 2007, which was 6.11 million. The blight, Phytophthora infestans. I usually have to wipe my lip when I say that. But Phytophthora infestans decimated the potato crop. And you can see, I don't know if you can see some of the images though, but once your potatoes going, you're going to see later when I talk about the Irish having to eat their seed potatoes, that's when you're in trouble. That's when famine is going to overwhelm you. They think that it came from Bolivia and Peru on the border of southeastern Peru and northwestern Bolivia near Lake Titicaca. They think that's where it originated, and of course it came over in one of the merchant ships. So, autumn of 1845, a fungus-based potato disease reaches Ireland from South America. Nearly half of the Irish population was entirely reliant upon the potato. Half of the Irish population. The blight spread during the wet spring and summer of 1846, causing an almost total failure of that year's crop. In 1847, many people had of necessity eaten their seed potatoes, and the overall crop was again disastrously low. 1848 saw yet another crop failure, and in 1849 and 1850, the blight was less severe. When the potato crop failed again in 1849, famine was accompanied by cholera outbreaks. This deadly cholera epidemic kills one of Ireland's greatest poets, James Clarence Mangan. Aside from Yeats, we all love Yeats. Second best, I should say. During the time of the famine in 1845 through 1851, it's estimated that over 1 million people died of starvation and the diseases that followed. Nearly 2 million emigrated, mostly to Canada, the United States, Australia, and England. The catastrophe was almost entirely borne by the laborer and small farmers who, because of their circumstances under the heels of the British landlords, had nothing but the meager potato crop that they planted to sustain their lives. Everything else they earned went to rent and the barest necessities. They were living on the edge to begin with. During the height of the genocide, and I'm going to use that term, and you'll see another term that I inflect, only one crop had failed and many were unaffected. Livestock thrived in Ireland. Relief efforts were stymied by the British government at every level. British landowners would rather see cattle and sheep on the land than Irish peasantry, i.e. Catholics. And they made sure it happened through cold strategy while staying within the tenancy laws. Technically, they didn't break the law. And again, feel free at any point. I'll be the first to say I have an axiom. When I speak, there's always people that think that they know more about the subject than I do, and people who actually do know more about the subject than I do. So if you hear anything, especially Dick, from here, jump in at any time. During the crises, as hundreds of thousands of Irish people were dying of starvation and its effects, crops and livestock were actually exported out of Ireland to England. Fact. Foreign relief from the United States and elsewhere was routed through English ports where taxes were extracted and precious time was wasted before they could reach Ireland. Humanitarian life-sustaining aid that civilized societies normally provide to those in need was denied by the British to the Irish on the grounds that such relief would spoil them in the future. Landlords wasted no time in legally evicting Irish tenants from their homes, even though there was no possibility for them to make rent payments. Eviction was likely to mean certain death with absolutely nowhere to go except to live in ditches known as scalpeens. Do you remember that first graph that I talked about, poor housing? I'm talking scalpeens. I'm talking ditches. I'm talking shrubbery hedges, piles of brush. That's what we're talking about, low-income housing. Emigration was only an option for the lucky few and prone to end in death of typhus or cholera or as human cargo in steerage on the ghastly coffin ships or famine ships, which we'll be speaking about momentarily. The scale of suffering endured by the Irish during the famine is almost unimaginable. The following account of a visit to Skibbereen in County Cork was written by Nicholas Cummins, a British magistrate, on Christmas Eve 1846. I apologize for my Cockney accent up front, but I'm going to give it a go. On reaching a spot where I was supposed to find the wretched hamlet apparently deserted, I entered some of the hovels to ascertain the cause, and the scenes which presented themselves were such as no tongue or pen can convey the slightest idea of. In the first, six famished and ghastly skeletons, to all appearances dead, were huddled in a corner on some filthy straw, their sole covering which seemed a ragged horse cloth, their wretched legs hanging about, naked above the knees. I approached with horror and found by a low moaning that they were still alive. They were in fever, four children, a woman, and what had once been a man. Suffice to say that in a few minutes I was surrounded by at least 200 such phantoms, such frightful specters as no words can describe, either from famine or fever. The demonic yells are still ringing in my ears, and their horrible images are fixed in my brain. That same morning, the police opened a house on the adjoining lands, and two corpses were found lying upon the mud floor, having been devoured by rats. A mother, herself in fever, was seen the same day to drag the corpse of her child, a girl about 12, perfectly naked, and leave it if half covered with stones. In another house, with 500 yards of Calvary Station at Skibbereen, the dispensary doctor found seven wretches lying unable to move under the same cloak. One had been dead many hours, but the others were unable to move either themselves or the corpse. When you study warfare, I've studied historical warfare, especially battles of the Revolution. Napoleon said something in the likes that it isn't the best soldier that survives, it's the one that can endure the fatigue. But the thing about a soldier is, if you're not warm and you're not dry, you are done. And people were forced out of their houses into the frigid, damp, cold Irish air. So they're starving, they're sick, and now they're giving no warmth and no place to stay dry. There were attempts to halt the evictions, but the riots were always brutally suppressed. I don't know if you can see these images, left-hand corner. There's a family trying to hold in the door as the British magistrates try to bash it down and the landlords. And then there's a riot, which always ended in the defeat of the Irish. And then they were put on the road, lower left-hand corner, lower right-hand corner, literally with no shoes on their feet. I get very passionate about this, so I apologize up front. No, I'm not going to apologize. During the years of the famine, a decline in the population of Ireland set in, one which has continued almost to the present day. In 1841, the population was 8.2 million, and merely 10 years later, it had declined by 2 million to 6.2 million. In 1976, the population of Ireland was 4.7 million. So as I mentioned, 30 years later, it had gone to 6.11 million. The Famine Queen, Queen Victoria. Born May 1819, died January 1901, she reigned way too long. Her reign was from 1837 until her death in 1901. She was the Empress of India. What's the Victorian era? Well, under her rule, the British people enjoyed a long period of prosperity as profits were gleaned from the expanding British Empire overseas. Domestically, there were improvements in industry, architecture, literature, art, and a large educated middle class developed. It was the time of the Peace of Britain, the Pax Britannica. That's, of course, if you ignore the brutal crushing of India. Well, she turned a blind eye to the crisis in Ireland. This is fact. She contributed only £5,000, that's £70,000 in today's money, to the famine relief effort. Lord John Russell, pictured there on the right as a potato sitting on a sofa, on a divan, and his ministry committed what is known as democide, a deliberate policy of negligence rather than of a planned killing. The Irish population, as I mentioned, 1841, 8.2 million, down to 6 million in 1851. In other words, Ireland was no longer a military threat to Britain. What happened after the hunger? Well, the Irish famine was proportionally more destructive of human life than the famines of modern times. It killed an eighth of the Irish population. The calamity was essentially man-made, a poison concoction of blind politics, scientific ignorance, rural suppression, and enforced poverty. Brilliant. Joseph Judge said that in 1981. The famine became a major platform for immigrant anger as the political liberties and freedom of opportunity that they encountered in America confirmed for them the potential of an independent Ireland, and it made them more passionate than their brethren at home. They got a taste of the good life, and they said everybody should have it. In the late 19th century and throughout the 20th century, English writers drove, and it's still going on today, something known as Irish revisionism in literature and art to undermine the basis of the Irish nationalism so as to leave Ireland without heroes or historical memory. It also played down the responsibility of the English government for exacerbating the famine. Only recently, in 1998, did British Prime Minister Tony Blair accept responsibility for the actions and inactions of the British government and offer a sincere and heartfelt apology. People forget about our brothers and sisters who suffered in the forgotten Highland potato famine of 1846 through 1857. The Scottish Highlands suffered a potato famine during the same period as the Irish famine, as their potato crops were also blighted by a fungal disease. Oatmeal was distributed in daily rations, 24 ounces per man, 12 ounces per woman, and 8 ounces per child. Do you know how small that is? That's a daily ration. Crofters were not given these rations. They were expected to work for them 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. Destitution roads were built through the craggy Scottish Highlands to expedite the eviction of peasants. Most landlords simply wanted the extermination of the population, although some landlords actually paid for their passage to Nova Scotia and Canada. Imagine building these roads. You're starving. You're building these roads so they can expedite the eviction of the Irish and Scottish off the land. In Wick, Cromarty, and Invergordon, grain was being exported from local harbors, relief grain. The Fields of Athenry, written by Pete St. John and first recorded by the Irish band ballad singer Danny Doyle in the 1970s, it was popularized by the Boston-based rock band Dropkick Murphys in 2003 on their album Blackout. My brother Jeff wrote the song Tessie. You ever hear that song, Tessie, that the Dropkicks played Red Sox games? My brother wrote that with them. And this is a song about Michael being deported to Botany Bay after stealing corn. I'm just going to play a little bit of it, so remember, it's Dropkicks and they're good old Irish boys. I'll just play a couple of verses, but it's they take old Irish ballads, put them to a contemporary melody. Basically, this story is about a man who steals food to feed his family, and he's sent away. Trevelyan's corn you stole. All right, we get the picture there. On another day, we can talk about the Dropkicks. Good guys. Ken Casey's a good guy. That's a picture of me and Ken Casey and Bruins defenseman Andrew Ferentz at a golf tournament. Ken's a good guy. So Trevelyan, Charles Edward Trevelyan, here's the guy. He's a senior British civil servant in the administration of the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in Dublin Castle, and he's one of the primary, what I call, culprits of inaction, as his reports to London understated the severity of the famine and insisted that problems would arise if the starving were assisted in any manner. This is the guy, the smoking gun. Trevelyan's corn, it may have not meant Irish wheat, but likely a reference to the relief maize that was being imported from America and subsequently being siphoned off from warehouses and subsequently exported. As this corn was meant for seed and not for milling, it was used mostly in gruel. A lot of the grain rotted on the docks and piles that were exposed to the elements as they were waylaid by bureaucracy. Trevelyan. The giving back. In 1985, Irish rocker Bob Geldof and founder of the Mammoth Benefit Concert Live Aid announced that the people of Ireland had given more to this fundraising effort per head of population than any other nation on earth. U2, the Cranberries, Van Morrison, Sinead O'Connor, and the Chieftains were also major Irish entertainers who performed for charitable causes. Irish relief charities Gold, Concern, Trocare, and Gorder play a major role in helping famine victims in Africa to this very day. They learned. The Famine Memorial, downtown Boston, crossing between Washington and School Street. Has everybody had a chance to see that? It's amazing the people that walk by and ignore it. Very moving. Yes, sir.
Dick had a ceremony there just the other day after our state convention. We can get a dedication. Coalition with National Famine Day in Iowa. We had a proclamation and a little ceremony down there.
And this is just, I'm going to go get to the Il Gross. I'm going to get to that in a moment, but that's a very moving story. So what do they got to do? They got to leave. They have to leave while they can. They've heard of a new beginning. There's talk of a better place. I'm not going to give you a history of the coffin ships and the famine ships, but I do want to tell you about a tragedy, the first one to precede the St. John, is the wreck of the Hannah. The hull was laid in Maryport, Ireland, and it left Newry on April 3rd, 1849, bound for Quebec. Captain Curry Shaw was displacing 150 to 200 tons. There were 200 Irish emigrants on board, along with 12 crew members. Well, at 4 a.m. on April 29th, 1849, in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, they struck an iceberg. First and second officer put a lifeboat out and left everybody else on deck. Many in their nightclothes leapt into the ice floes and slid into the icy water. The Bark Nicaragua saw the distress flag a little after 5 p.m. They saw over 50 men, women, and children freezing to death on one large iceberg. Some had been crushed to death between the massive ice chunks. No pen, Captain Marshall observes, can describe the pitiable situation of the poor creatures. They are all but naked, cut and bruised and frostbitten. They were parents who had lost their children, children with loss of parents. Many, in fact, were perfectly insensible. The numbers got on board the Nicaragua were 129 passengers and seamen. The greater part of these are frostbitten. So you see 71 passengers go missing and 12 seamen. So about 83 people go missing, less those two guys that took off of the boat. 50 to 60 people were crushed between the ice or frozen to death. They arrived in Quebec on May 14, 1849, and the fate of those two men who took the lifeboat, unknown. Dick McDonald's not here, but Dick gave me some information about the Jeannie Johnston. Did anybody, you got a chance, Dick, to go in there? To the Jeannie Johnston, but this is a successful coffin ship. This ship crossed the Atlantic, it brought over 2,500 passengers, 16 trips, without a disaster. And then, not to go over the hard parts, but 16 Atlantic crossings.
They actually had a doctor on board.
Really? And I think, Dick, we can attribute it to the great captain that steered the ship. And his name was Captain James Attridge. Because of his skill in navigation and care, and he cared for all of his passengers, he died in 1885, but he was one of the friends of the Irish. Talking about life on board, I'm not going to go there. We don't have the time today about that. But I'm going to read something from Friday, July 9th, 1847. And this is a first-hand account of the coffin ship misery. Quote, "The brother of the two men who died on the 6th instant followed them today, and he was seized with dismay from the time of their death. The old sails being all used up, his remains were placed in two meal sacks, and a weight being fastened at foot, the body was placed upon one of the hatch battens from which, when raised over the bulwark, it fell into the deep and was no more seen. He left two little orphans, one of whom, a boy, 7 years of age, I noticed in the evening wearing his deceased father's coat." Part of the history of this is the weather. Now, I try to tell people, in New England, the years 1849 through 1851, we had some horrific weather here in New England. I count 6 gales, 2 blizzards, 6 nor'easters, 1 you could consider a Category 1 hurricane, heavy winds, a severe fire. It was just a very bad time in New England. And the October gale, the great thing about the internet is now I don't have to hunt and guess going to historical societies or libraries that I might stumble across an article that's turned face down and a book that nobody knows about, you can find it online with Google Books. And this is how I got this information. In fact, a gentleman from Virginia pointed me towards this October gale of 1849. But it came out of the tropics and was reported to be roaring through the shipping lanes of the middle Atlantic on Friday, October 5th, 1849. So up the coast comes this storm. Meanwhile, coming across the Atlantic is the brig St. John. The rain began in New York City at 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, October 6th, 1849. The barometer dropped to 29.60 at 9 p.m., and the wind was blowing out of the southeast. The peak of the gale in New York was between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. and inflicted severe damage, according to the New York Tribune. This is a nor'easter of epic proportions hugging the Atlantic coastline. By dawn, the barometer read 29.30. The wind shifted then to the northeast. In the 2 days of the gale, 2.43 inches of rain were measured. The Presbyterian Church on 29th Street collapsed. There was an exhibition pavilion at 8th Street and 4th Street, 4th Avenue, where two large dioramas by Daguerre, who I showed you that daguerreotype earlier, were on display and was blown down, and it tore a priceless canvas nearly 1,000 feet long, assessed at $5,000, 1849. And that's Louis Daguerre, lower left-hand corner. And then this is called the Boulevard du Temple, 1838. This is the first photograph of a person. I'm going to show you where the person is, 1838.
See him with his leg up? I know you can't, but you'll need the Hubble Space Telescope back there to see it, but...
I always thought that was kind of neat. Wind and barometer measurements at Sag Harbor, Long Island on Sunday, October 7th, 1849 as follows. 6 a.m., wind east by north, barometer 29.14. 9 a.m., east-northeast, 29.13. So it's holding in the low 29s. 3 p.m., north-northeast, 29.11 inches. And 6 o'clock north, 29.35 inches. 6.5 inches of rain fell in 33 hours. The storm center passed along the eastern tip of Long Island. At Fort Trumbull in New London, Connecticut, 6.15 inches of rain was recorded. At Providence, the heaviest part of the storm came during the early evening hours of October 7th, but the barometer didn't dip to 29.09 inches until 3 o'clock. Amherst and Framingham, Massachusetts, report severe damage. In Nantucket, it blew with great violence from midnight until 2, but caused little damage. And at Provincetown, some small fishing vessels were lost when they broke free of their moorings. So rain began to fall along the New England coast at 6 o'clock on Saturday, October 6th, 1849. St. John is inbound. It's out on George's Banks at this point. By midnight, a violent gale was blowing from the northeast, and the rain was falling in torrents. By Sunday, October 7th, telegraph lines, trees, and chimneys were down, and sea vessels were being driven onto land. All telegraph communication to the south of Boston ceased. In Chelsea, one of the walls to the Universalist Church was blown down, and 2 inches of snow fell in Temple, New Hampshire, which is 10 miles north of the Massachusetts border. Now on to the Grampuses. The Grampuses are off the coast of Cohasset and Scituate. Basically, to the right, do you see the circle where the Grampuses are? And to the right is Minot's Ledge. There's a Minot's Ledge Lighthouse was built there in 1849, so when the St. John was coming across, the superstructure of Minot's Ledge Lighthouse was being built. The first lighting of the lighthouse didn't take place until January 1st, 1850, and it was destroyed in the lighthouse storm of April 1851, where two lighthouse keepers were swept away. In fact, the lamp was seen lit at 10 p.m. that night, and then 2 o'clock in the morning, they heard the bell as the thing toppled over. But that's another lecture that I give on another day. It's called the New England Lighthouse Storm and Yankee Gale. But just some other factoids about Minot's Ledge Lighthouse. Scituate's been the scene of countless shipwrecks. Between 1832 and 1841, there were 40 wrecks on this and neighboring reefs. Between 1817 and 1847, it was estimated that 40 lives and over $300,000 worth of property had been lost in shipwrecks there. So I.W.P. Lewis, in 1843, of the Lighthouse Service, an inspector, emphasized the great need for a lighthouse there. Captain William H. Swift recommended an iron pile lighthouse, that's on stanchions, 9 of them. He built it on the ledge. The ledge was only 20 feet wide and exposed at low tide, being dry only about 2 or 3 hours a day. So construction on this narrow ledge, on this 75-foot open-work light structure, could only be done when the tide was at its ebb, and the workers would stay on a ship moored just off Minas Ledge to build it, and of course if there was a storm they'd put into the harbor. Just some other factoids. Samuel de Champlain went by Quanahasset, he called it, and then they later called it Conahasset, and then shortened it to Cohasset. But Champlain went by in 1609, and John Smith in 1614 actually had a gun and arrow fight with some of the local inhabitants there. What's the St. John? Well, it's a brig. It displaces 200 tons. Its cargo is Irish immigrants. The owner is Henry Comerford of Galway and Ballykeed House in Kilfenora. The captain's Martin Oliver of Boramore, Galway, and the crew of 9, not including the captain, and 110 passengers from North Clare and Connemara. St. John leaves Galway, Ireland on September 5th, 1849. She made Cape Cod Light at 5 p.m. on Saturday evening, October 6th, 1849. So let's go back to that storm that we were talking about there. As she comes into Cape Cod Light, she's running right into the teeth of that nor'easter, which is racing up the coast. So they threw anchor, and the captain passed a ration of grog to his crew. He suggested, ironically, to the passengers that they celebrate their last night on board the St. John. He was right. By 1 a.m. on Sunday, October 7, 1849, she stood away northward from Scituate Light, about 2.5 miles out to sea to clear the land until light. She remained there until about 4 a.m. So she backed off and threw anchor, just waiting till the dawn light so she could navigate. When the dawn began to break, he tacked and she stood south-southwest, and the captain called the weather, quote, very thick. The ship was being driven southward towards Cohasset Bay, so she came inside Minot's Ledge, where a lighthouse was inoperable and still under construction. At 6:30 a.m., after seeing the British brig Kathleen anchored near Hooksett Rock, he tried to lend assistance to her, but he found that he could not fetch up and assist the Kathleen, which was now foundering badly. So he was being selfish. His selflessness by trying to assist a fellow mariner eventually would lead to the demise of his passengers. He saw the Kathleen in trouble, went to help it. So he threw over both of the St. John's anchors, and at 7 a.m. they began to drag the anchors. She began to drift swiftly towards Grampus Ledge. Her sails were now shredded. Captain Oliver then decided to cut away the masts of the St. John. And any mariners, if you know from 19th century, 18th century, once you cut away the masts, you have nowhere else to go. That's the last-ditch effort to save your vessel, to save your lives. The event was being witnessed now by residents of the Glades House. So in the Glades section, people are now out on the beach watching this. Enormous breakers repeatedly lifted up the ship and hurled her against the rocks repeatedly. The captain would later recall that these waves were mountains high. A hole was broken in the hull, and those below deck were drowned within minutes. They were the first to go. The brig then began to break up. People now gathered on the shore and were horrified to see people being swept off the deck by the dozens and into the boiling surf. Even though the wind howled and the surf pounded the shore, witnesses swore that they could hear the screams of the victims. Now, take that piece of data and play it against the next story that I tell you. So here's the famous artist's rendering of the wreck of the St. John. It appeared in Harper's Weekly in October of 1849. And this is the closest historical visual record that I could find in regard to the St. John. The jolly boat was hanging by its tackle alongside the stern until the stern rigging broke. So the jolly boat is one of the boats that fell into the water, and it was being swept away. Captain Oliver, the second mate, and two of the crewmen, which were two apprentice boys, jumped into the maelstrom to secure the jolly boat. But just then, about 25 passengers also jumped into the water, into the boat, and swamped her. Only Captain Oliver survived as he grabbed a rope that was hanging from the quarterdeck, and he was pulled aboard by the ship's mate and nephew of the ship's owner, Henry Comerford. So all these people now are thrown into the sea with the exception of the captain. The longboat is then launched, and several passengers jumped into the water to reach her. None did. They all perished. People clung to wreckage and were slammed into the barnacle-clad rocks. The captain, the first mate, a Mr. Crawford, and the remaining members of the crew, I count 7, and only one passenger reached the longboat. A lifeboat was launched from land towards the brig Kathleen as the life-saving crew assumed that all from the St. John were safely aboard on the longboat. So in other words, heading back to the people from the Glades who said that they could hear screams coming in from the boat, the wind must have shifted because people in the rescue boats, the life-saving boats, could not hear or misinterpreted what was told to them by the people in the longboat. They assumed that everybody was safe in the St. John and they headed towards the Kathleen. When in actuality, everybody in the Kathleen was safe, and it were the people that were in the St. John that were in peril. They could not see through the spray, these are the rescue men, and the howling wind, and they didn't realize that there were 200 people in jeopardy. By 4 o'clock on the 7th, 27 bodies had washed ashore, 21 women, 3 men, 3 children. Austin Kern, Catherine Flanagan, Betsy Higgins, Mary Kane, Michael Fitzpatrick, Michael Gibbon, Barbara Keneally, Mary Slatterly, Michael Redding, Honora Cullen, Honora Burke were among the saved. Patrick Sweeney of Galway perished along with his wife and 9 children. Mr. Lathrop, who sheltered survivors in his house, waded into the surf to retrieve a parcel of clothing and quickly realized that he had an infant in his arms. The infant was said to be in excellent health. The St. John was in shards by 8 a.m. 8 women and 7 men made their way to the shore almost dead of exhaustion. 21 were saved, 99 were lost. Some had to have their hands pried off of the flotsam to which they were clinging. People like Mr. Holmes, a railroad conductor, lined the shore anxious to help rescue the living and retrieve the dead. All 7 first-class passengers were lost, including 3 nieces of the ship's owner, Mr. Comerford. A man clung to a timber with his mouth open, skin a deep purple, and fixed teeth and bulging eyes. Total shock. By nightfall, 46 bodies were recovered. Now news begins to reach. First from the Boston Bee, they say that disasters by the late storm, awful shipwreck at Minot's Ledge. Of course, we know about the Cohasset Central Cemetery Memorial Cross erected by the Ancient Order of Hibernians. That's why it's so great to be here this morning, bring closure on this. On May 30th, 1914. And guys, when is the Mass?
The first Sunday in October.
First Sunday. Can you keep me posted and we can get a, let's get a good contingent this year, huh? In honor of St. John and our ancestors to go down there to that Mass. I think that would be wonderful. Gros Eel, how do you say it, Dick?
Gros Eel.
Gros Eel. Now, as Dick mentioned, this is about that, but the people that died there from disease and were left for dead and piled up and thrown out, put out as if they were recycling. And I'd like to go out to that. Let me know when you do that trip, and if I'm available, I'd love to go up and see that. But that's the cross. And you can see that, you say, for miles?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Good.
These photographs, Dick McDonald isn't here, but he gave me some great ones. Leathermullen, County Galway, Star of the Sea, Rialto Namara. Did anybody go on that trip with Dick? Okay. There's a wood carving of the brig St. John in the back of the church door to the far right there. And a memorial stone in honor of the victims of the St. John, which left in September from Ireland in 1849. I'm not going to really get into Thoreau. Usually, we don't have time, but I'll tee off on this guy. One of my heroes, but this guy, he hears about it. He reads the Boston Bee, and he's heading down to Cape Cod on one of his nature walks. And again, he was a philosopher, naturalist. This isn't a Thoreau lecture. But he's looking for dead bodies to poke at with a stick and write about, and to write sardonically about. And he gets to see some of it. That's a daguerreotype, 1856. Just some background on him. I want to just... I'll tee off on him just for... Nathaniel Hawthorne says, Thoreau is as ugly as sin, long-nosed, queer-mouthed, and with uncouth and rustic, though courteous manners, corresponding very well with such an exterior, but his ugliness is of an honest and agreeable fashion and becomes him much better than beauty. And then, of course, Thoreau wore a neck beard for many years, which he insisted many women found attractive. However, Louisa May Alcott reportedly mentioned to Ralph Waldo Emerson that Thoreau's facial hair will most assuredly deflect amorous advances and preserve the man's virtue in perpetuity. And just lastly, among the eclectic things that I study great student rebellions, and I came across all of these food fights at Harvard, and the irony isn't lost here. While people are starving in Ireland, they're throwing their food around the cafeteria in Harvard. But Thoreau's grandfather, Asa Dunbar, was in the Great Butter Rebellion of 1766, and there was another Bread and Butter Rebellion in 1805, a Rotten Cabbage Rebellion in 1807, and the Great Rebellion of 1814. Moving on. Anyways, just some background about Thoreau. So he eventually dies in 1862. Aware that he was dying, his last words were, "Now comes good sailing," followed by two lone words, "Moose and Indian." And he died on May 6th. Oh, and his Aunt Louisa asked him in his last weeks if he had made peace with God, and he said, quite simply, "I didn't know that we ever quarreled." So he wrote this thing called Cape Cod the Shipwreck, and I'm not going to read the text in that, but basically he's wandering down the beach with a buddy. He gets off the train, and then he gets off a wagon. He sees people running towards the beach across the common in Cohasset. And he's kind of disappointed that he doesn't see carcasses everywhere. He sees flotsam. He sees what's left of the brig St. John out there. And he's got his walking stick, and he's basically making fun of the dead people and the people that suffered. I'm not going to go through it, but it's just not a good background. But that's basically my story and my presentation this morning. Again, I'm very, very proud to be a Hibernian in Division 14. I've been a member since 2005. I'm very proud to be a part of St. Patrick's Parish. To my brothers and sisters, all I say to you is God bless you and thank you for upholding Catholicism and Hibernianism. Thank you.
Thank you, John. That was great. Just like when we saw him down the library, it's very informative and it's great to see. And you know, when you see something like this, you just say, wow, there should be more people here to see this because it really is that good. And maybe we'll have some more from John in the future. I hope we can. And and maybe pass the word along to some people and just, you know, I try to tell a few people that, you know, you should come down and see this because it's something to see. And it's really, really, like I said, very informative. So thanks again, John.
Thank you, Leo.
And on behalf of everybody here at Division 14, we want to thank everybody that showed up today, and it was a wonderful, wonderful morning. Thank you very much.
In fact, there's a movie on TV.